This is the OANDA podcast, brought to you by Jazz FM's Business Breakfast.
Welcome to the OANDA Market Insights podcast, where we're examining the week's financial and business news and inevitably talking too much about Brexit. I'm Nick Howard. Joining me is OANDA senior market analyst Craig Earlham. Craig, very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
I'm going to kick off with what we can, I suppose, charitably call mayhem, which was this week's Brexit news. The Prime Minister grasping defeat from the jaws of victory, going from winning a no confidence vote to embarrassment in Brussels. We talked a lot about Brexit on this programme and elsewhere, but in terms of how markets are reacting, in terms of what happens next, I mean, what's been your views about this week?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite extraordinary to think that this week actually started with planning for a vote on her Brexit deal, a vote which she called on her Brexit deal, which she very quickly became aware of the fact that she was going to lose the vote on her Brexit deal. Then it was a conversation in Parliament about the fact that she was cancelling the vote. Then there were times there was actually suggestions that she would have to get Parliament to vote on her ability to cancel the vote on her Brexit deal, which she also thought she may lose. Like this week has, to say this has been extraordinary is a huge, huge understatement. And Monday feels like such a long time ago already. Since then, we, as you say, we had the 48 letters handed in, which has been long awaited. It feels like we've been talking about the fact that we've been on 47 now for months and months and months. We finally got to the 48. And you were thinking, if they've hit the 48 now, they must be really confident that they can get those extra votes needed to topple May. They must have had some really strong assurances. And then that vote gets easily defeated in Parliament, 2/3 to 1/3, which you view as a position of relative strength for May, really. She survived the vote. It wasn't particularly close. We now have, she has 12 months where until she can be challenged again. And all of a sudden, she goes from a position of apparent strength with the obvious noise around from Brexiteers, the stauncher Brexiteers, I should say, the Rees-Moggs of this world, telling us that, well, 52-48 was significant, 60-40 is completely insignificant and she should still resign anyway. And then she goes to Brussels. And you're thinking, I said yesterday, I was never that confident she'd get much from Brussels. I feel like Brussels has a few more hands they can play before the no deal becomes a real prospect in their eyes.
Sure, and we'll get to that in a minute.
But you thought they may at least offer something. And it seems she's come, the visit has really been a big setback for Theresa May, that to the point that she, the vote now will not take place before Christmas. Fortunately, we don't have a deadline shortly after that we absolutely must hit. And it now looks as though we're very much going to be in a position that we almost thought we were going to be in a number of months ago. I was really surprised when they agreed this back in November. When they came to an agreement on deal, I remember saying at the time, I can't believe this hasn't happened at the 11th hour. Usually, it's very much, this is a minute to midnight deal, a dark room until 4 a.m, and then they all bang their heads together and decide, you know what, here's the agreement. And we were saying at the time, I can't believe they've done this early. This is so unlike them.
Yeah, got in before the last minute.
And little did we know.
Yeah, how much of this feels to me like one of these weeks which journalists love, but the rest of the country tears their hair out, which is that we've had a lot of noise and a lot of headlines, and yet we're no further along really in terms of substance than we were 168 hours ago. Nothing's really changed.
Well, I think there's one thing that's changed, and this is the fact that there was always going to be the possibility, and we've seen, everyone's seen 100 flow diagrams now about the different routes that we can go down towards a deal or a no deal scenario. And all, basically, what these flow charts showed was there's a number of checkpoints that we may have to bypass in order to eventually get to a point when we know what's going to happen. The first of those was the vote of no confidence in Theresa May. That checkpoint's been done. We've moved on from that. Another one would be, for example, a vote of no confidence in the government. And I don't think we're too far away from that one, because if Theresa May comes back to Parliament and all she's got is the deal she cancelled last time, the deal that she cancelled the vote on last time, I think that's swiftly followed by a vote of no confidence, because this is something that Labour already backs, the Lib Dems already back, the SNP already backs, and she's very reliant now on the DUP. And that's assuming that there's not members of her own party who wouldn't consider I know this sounds utterly ridiculous, but that wouldn't consider actually backing it themselves because they see that this is the only way they could possibly salvage their idealistic version of Brexit. That's
sure.
extreme, but the DUP could very much oppose
yeah,
it.
I mean, no Conservative wants Jeremy Corbyn to get in at this stage just because, you know, it's their opposition.
Well, we have to remember that's not a guarantee.
But Theresa May has now said that she won't stand for another election. So if there was to be a snap general election, then presumably another leader would have to be found. She would have to resign by her own rules. But let's just back off that a little bit. Let's just talk about Brexit, because as you say, we have the vote in January now. So legally, the government have to give a meaningful vote to MPs on the Brexit deal. If, as seems likely, we don't get a huge amount of substantial difference from what was what failed to be put in front of Parliament this week, we assume that they vote down that deal. What happens then? Can you really see this going to March in a no deal? Because I'll be honest, I can't see a responsible government letting that happen.
I can't see a responsible government letting that happen, but I also can't see the EU letting that happen because it's not in their interest either. If you imagine that the entire reason for a backstop is to avoid a hard border on the island of Ireland, then allowing a no deal to happen would be the most irresponsible way of enforcing the one thing you've been trying to avoid in the long term. So I don't think there's any appetite from any side, from any MPs or anyone in Brussels of seriousness who are actually looking at no deal as a good option. But it's a case of these procedures, the flow charts that they have in Brussels or that they have in the Houses of Parliament right now, they've got their own laid out and they know how many steps they have until no deal actually becomes a realistic possibility. So they know that things that they can do now before prior to that actually happening. So, and this is one of the reasons why I think if Theresa May does come back to Parliament and make it back to Parliament, I should say as well, with no changes to a deal. I think this is one of the reasons why this isn't happening before Christmas, because the closer we are to that, I think it's what, January 21st deadline.
So debating will begin on the 14th, because we're again going through the 5 days of Brexit debate.
And the closer we are to that 21st, it becomes more of a no deal or Theresa deal when you're reaching that point. And I think that works in her favour, because the issue with the vote earlier this week was if MPs knew that if they voted it down, that they would have a second bite at something before no deal became realistic. And this is all part of the political games, which and the brinkmanship and everything that we're going through right now is you can't take everything that everyone says seriously. You have to take everything with a piece of salt, because, for example, there's no chance, no matter how much MPs have been criticising Theresa May's deal and saying it's the worst thing since whatever, there's no chance. They've also been saying that this better than no deal is even worse. So faced with those two choices, I still think they would go for Theresa May's deal. And Theresa May, I think, is trying to construct a scenario where they have to pick between the two.
Yeah, and yet it is a false choice, isn't it? That within the deal, within legislation, it is possible to extend Article 50. We also have the ECJ, the European Court of Justice, ruling that Article 50 is unilaterally reversible. This idea that it is no deal or May deal or no deal is false. I mean, it is a political construct.
Exactly. And that's
But doesn't that push things on even further?
It does. And it creates another range of possibilities for how this can actually go as well. And this is why, no wonder everyone's so confused. I'm confused. I'm sitting here right now and I've spent all week trying to piece this together in my head as to where we could possibly go and when we could do it and who could do what and when they could do it. And even now, you we're talking about possibilities that are actually realistically on the table, and we're still in agreement that neither side wants no deal. It's a case of how do we get there? And as we said off air prior to the show, this is one of the reasons why the European Commission probably was so disappointed with the ECJ's ruling on revoking Article 50, the UK's ability to unilaterally do so. because that has taken a little bit of the leverage away from their negotiations. And these negotiations are all about leverage. The Article 50 was designed to give the leverage entirely to Europe and not to the country that was voting to leave. And they've lost a little bit of that with this ruling.
Yeah, although I doubt that any country will look at the last 2 years in the UK and say, you know what, not only do we want that, but we want to be able to spring in and out of that indefinitely. But spreading this around, stretching this out, is not going to be good for businesses. It's not good for political unity. There's very few people who it is actually positive for.
It's not good for our sanity either. Right. And I'm not talking about just myself and you who spend half our lives talking about it. I'm talking about people. People are getting bored, and people are getting bored quickly. And with that, it's going to come pressure on the politicians. And if that's not enough to get things moving, the markets will have their say, because we have to remember that in all of this, investors are watching what's going on, and they're becoming increasingly frustrated, but also increasingly losing faith in a solution to be found. And it does feel like we are sleepwalking now towards an accidental no-deal Brexit, if that's possible.
Talk me through, actually, the financial side of this. If I was a canny investor, if I was backing away from sterling, for example, would I be making lots of money at the moment?
The pound has been slipping, and especially when it became apparent that Theresa May was going to face a no-confidence vote and that she was cancelling the vote on her deal, then pound has been slipping since. We did see a bit of a bounce back a couple of days ago when she actually won the vote, but that was a very brief bounce, and we are, when I left the office this morning, we were heading south again with regards to the pound. So it seems that people are losing faith in it. And this is a pound that, while we were seeing general weakness, we were seeing it hold at certain levels. So with against the euro, it was 90 cents. We weren't breaching this level. And this, for me, was a sign of confidence that we were going to get somewhere eventually. It was not a case of if, it was a case of when. The same was true with the US dollar. Against the US dollar, we were holding on 126.50. We were never really breaching that level. We were bouncing higher on good news. We were falling short, but that level was holding. So this was levels.
There's a ceiling on confidence, as there were.
And it broke. It broke when it became apparent that Theresa May was facing a no-confidence vote, and we are now still outside of those levels. So this suggests to me that it's finally starting to take its toll. That's not to say that we've seen a dramatic move. People don't care about 0.5%, 1% moves.
Sure,
that's not
unless
have
you're
an
moving your millions of holiday cash around, it's not going to make a substantial difference, but exactly. It's still annoying. What about in terms of businesses, for example? Because months ago we were talking about the point at which people put their contingency plans into place. But you've got to have a little bit of lead-in time for this. Are you seeing businesses starting to commit funds to this?
The bigger the business, the more we are seeing contingency plans put in place. We've seen the banks have already looked at setting up offices and already have offices in other locations and have already started moving jobs over. I think the Bank of England estimated it at around 5,000 jobs, which in the grand scheme of things isn't massive, but it shows that they are putting provisions in place in order to speed up, make the process as smooth as possible in the event of a no-deal Brexit. But this is actually one of the more worrying things, is that a number of businesses don't have that luxury. Because putting provisions in place, moving operations abroad, is very much a luxury that's really afforded to the firms who are making a lot more money, who they can therefore afford everything that comes with it. It's not just a case of setting up an office. It's the entire administration process which comes with it, the exploration, sure, the research, everything that comes with it.
This licenses is and things like
that. I saw a number. I can't remember off the top of my head what the number is. But the amount of money spent on making provisions in the case of Brexit and in case of no deal Brexit happening is staggering, and there's a lot of businesses in this country that do not have that luxury. So this is actually the more worrying thing. It's not a case of are we seeing examples of it moving. The more worrying thing is we're probably seeing plenty of evidence of companies not making provisions at all in the hope that common sense prevails and that they don't have to, and that they won't have had to waste effort and money that they don't have in order to do so. And I genuinely believe that that's where we would see a lot of the pain in the aftermath of a messy no-deal Brexit, which again is still my base case. I do not believe it will happen, because I do think that common sense will prevail amongst people who will be held responsible for whatever happens after.
I'm going to leave that note of optimism to move on to other stories around the globe. And let's move to central banks, which have been now for several years the major driver of economic information in the globe. We have had the European Central Bank actually end its 2.5 trillion euro quantitative easing, its bond buying package, just this week. But it seems to have come at precisely the wrong time, because we're seeing slowdown in the European economy, and also just a general lack of confidence as the politics shifts.
But I think we hear that every time a central bank looks to tighten. We've been through a decade in which central banks haven't had to tighten or haven't been able to tighten monetary policy. There's an entire generation of people, and it includes myself, who have never even lived through a interest rate hiking cycle. So the central banks have been very accommodative for far too long, and that does create potential instability in the financial system in the longer term, and that's something that these central banks are extremely aware of. So yes, it's not the perfect time to be ending a quantitative easing program, but we also have to remember that this was unconventional monetary policy that had never been used before. So by ending it, they're actually just ending this period, this experiment that they were doing to try and support the economy through an extraordinary time. We're not in an extraordinary time anymore. We're in a we're in an unsavory time. We're seeing rise of populism. We are seeing growth, even if it's low. Unemployment has fallen down to more sustainable levels. The situation now compared to in 2015 when the bond buying program was launched is vastly, vastly different. So I'm actually of the opinion that we don't need quantitative easing anymore. And after a decade, we have to be looking at normalizing the interest rate markets, because otherwise we are just effectively sowing the seeds for a future crisis, and there's already evidence of bubbles popping up.
But what if we are sowing those seeds with this actual pullback? One of the issues with QE at the time was that it was effectively central banks taking over where really governments should have. The research papers have been written that austerity didn't work, and if it had not gone through essentially kind of cutting growth, then the QE program wouldn't have been necessary in the way that it was. I put to you that if you actually create a weapon like quantitative easing and say, we've used it once, it works, but we'll never use it again, you'll always end up eating those words.
But then you look at a situation, and actually I would say as well, like the central banks will use QE again. And the next financial crisis that we have, and it's not going to be necessarily like the 2008 global financial crisis. It could
just be an
ordinary
recession.
Sure, but you
never get a full repeat, yeah.
But there may be a minor recession, and they will use QE again, because they will look back on this, and there is going to be many, many more research papers written over the next decade or two to evaluate just how successful quantitative easing was, and whether the pros made up for the cons that come with undergoing such a huge monetary experiment. But I think central banks will look at this right now and say, this was successful. We stabilised the system at a time when everything looked like it was on the verge of collapse. We look at the situation in the US right now, where they are starting to unwind, and there hasn't been any major issues associated with the unwinding of this. The US has raised interest rates now 2% compared to where it was during the financial crisis, when they were pumping more bonds. They've already started allowing the expiring bonds to not be reinvested. So gradually, slowly but surely, their balance sheet is actually starting to reduce. And this is what the aims of the ECB will be. It's not right now. They are going to continue to reinvest. So let's not forget, there is still going to be those trillions of euros pumping through the financial system. They're not withdrawing anything. They're just not adding to the pile. So there's huge amounts of accommodation still. And that, on top of the fact that we've got pretty much zero interest rates, there's so much accommodation still, and they are going to continue to support the economy, but very gradually and slowly but surely, they're going to start tightening monetary policy and bringing us back to normal. And like I say, the lesson that we've had from the last few years from the US, and this is pre-Trump, pre-tax cuts, pre-3.5% growth. This was when the economy was growing at 2% and was ticking along nicely, gradual improvements. The lessons we had there was it's actually worked quite well. And now the US is in a far healthier position than Europe is right now, because if they're faced with a recession, they can actually cut interest rates. Europe can't. And so you have to slowly but surely move your way out of this. You just may want to be sure that you're not tightening too quickly, so you trigger a recession rather than stop one.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's look ahead to 2019. Let's look ahead to what is potentially an even newer normal. We are in a period of global uncertainty. We have issues all around the world, political, economic, fiscal, corporate. What are the trigger points for you in the coming year? What are you looking for as the major risks?
I think every region has its own, but I think one that all countries seem to have in common. One thing that they all have in common is we are seeing a rise of populism everywhere we look. And that's, in some countries, is going to...
We never define this. Would you agree with me? So populism, you mean simple solutions to complex problems?
Yes, but it's also there's also a lot of other things that these populist parties have in common. One is it's very, very much a us first, them second type approach. You've seen Donald Trump with America first. We've seen the UK, and I know those are the fundamental problems behind it, so I don't want to just pigeonhole Brexit and say this is a populism march and nothing else. There is huge, there is a number of things which resulted in the actual Brexit vote itself and the result, and there's no point in trying to just call it one thing. But people will always associate it with prioritising the UK at the and not the bloc as a whole. We've seen it in France as well. Even if we do currently have a Europhile in charge, someone who is very pro-Europe, who is very much in the centre ground, slightly right of centre, we are seeing parties in France right now who are more on the populist side of things. And these are people, again, prioritising France first, wanting to spend more money, wanting to go against previous advice with regards to domestic spending and these types of issues. We are seeing this across numerous countries right now. And I think that that is a risk. And it's a risk primarily for Brussels, because we've seen right now we're in a situation with Italy where there is big disputes over Italy's fiscal deficit. Now, Italy believes that this is a sovereign issue, that they should be able to decide how they spend and what they spend. But Brussels has its rules for a reason, because they're trying to align all of these countries. And if they allow one to go off and spend as and how they wish, and at a time when all these economies are so linked up. So if you can have a little crisis of your own if this goes wrong, but it will have an impact on everyone else. That's the whole reason why these rules are so aligned. This is going to create problems for Europe. And I think that is one of the major risks for next year, is the fact that we're seeing a rise of populism in Italy. We've seen the protests and the riots in France recently, and we've seen what the popularity ratings are for Emmanuel Macron at this moment in time. Angela Merkel has been a driving force of stability for Europe over the course of this global financial crisis and the European debt crisis which followed. She will be moving on. I know she plans to hang around until 2021, I think it is. But when you've just elected a new leader of your party, I think there's surely conversations happening in the background.
Aspect, yeah.
Exactly. I think one of the reasons she stepped down as well, again, is because populism in Germany has been growing throughout the refugee crisis. So this, I think, is what the major risk for 2019. We're also facing a year where global economic growth is expected to slow. We're already seeing a slowdown in China. China, the US are having negotiations at the moment to try and avert a trade war. But it's hard to be too optimistic at this stage, because it feels like there's a lot more that can go wrong than can go right. But we can hope that the next 90 days goes well, and that we can actually start to see some progress, and we can start to see tariffs removed. But again, that's another major risk, because they're the two world's largest economies. And if they start chipping away at each other's growth and start the trade barriers start to go up, then you would imagine that it could, that there's potential therefore for it to follow anywhere in other countries. We've seen, again, Trump targeting the car industry in Europe, for example, as an example of that. So there are risks. But then it's also worth pointing out, because I don't want to sound like a doom and gloomer, the global economy is still doing well. The UK, yes, Brexit hasn't happened yet, but I think many people have been surprised at just how resilient the economy has been throughout the last 2 years of uncertainty. I think many economies may have suffered more than the UK has, and that's been helped actually as well by the fact that the global economy has been performing well. The US is expected to slow down next year, but it's growing at 3.5% to 4%. If it slows down to 2.5%, that's still a very good level of growth. And with all of this and all the threats to Europe with regards to populism in particular, and the fact that the economy has slowed this year, again, it's still growing at a decent rate. Unemployment is still falling. Countries are still gradually recovering. And fiscal purse strings are loosening along with that, because they are now viewing these things in a slightly different manner. So I do think there are tailwind risks. There are upside risks for the global economy next year, but we can't ignore what is. some significant headwinds, and you have to you feel in some cases are very much self-inflicted wounds that we can't ignore for next year, because I think if we think this year has been eventful, I think next year is going to be more so.
Greg, mixed things to end on, though, although admittedly a bit more cheery than I was expecting for such a difficult week. Greg, an absolute pleasure to speak to you, as always. This is the Oanda Market Insights podcast, available from iTunes and all the places where podcasts live. Let's be honest, things won't get any quieter in the news, so do join us again next week. That was Craig Earnham, market analyst at Oanda, and I'm Nick Howard.
Was the Oanda podcast from the team behind Jazz FM's Business Breakfast, a daily early morning 30-minute briefing for the day ahead. On air from 6 a.m. Listen to Jazz FM on DAB, online, or just ask Alexa.